watching the boat slip away. As I raise my hands above my head, struggling against the waves. Even the seagulls have left me for dead. No one on the deck saw me fall. Panel 1. Overhead shot. A self-deprecating writer clutches a greasy grilled cheese as ice-cold water splashes over his shivering body. He's crying, but the water masks the tears and the pain. I write because no one really understands sandwiches like I do. Panel 2. A young man sits on the floor of his bedroom, back against the closed door. His head is bowed, his eyes are closed. He grabs the hair at the side of his head, as though ready to rip his scalp from his skull. The lettering drifts from the small crack between the door and the frame, tumbling down towards him and swirling around his head. His partner is driving him mad. I write because it's the only voice I have. Panel 3. This woman, a smoldering beauty with dark eyes, stares to the camera from across a crowded room. Her gaze cuts through the mass of people as though there is kinetic power to her brilliance that no force on earth could repel. She's wearing a playful smile, inviting us closer, beckoning us into her story, daring us to follow. I write because I love her. Panel 4. He stands, hunched over a register, blank and broken. His finger is pressing the same button it presses every day, day in, day out. Cash. There is a line of 20 people, all wearing the same hollow expression. Everything outside of this destroyed cashier and his zombie consumer horde is blank. There is no background, no color, only a slab of infinite gray, white, and black. I write because it makes me come alive when everything else fails. What are your reasons for writing? Why do you do it? What is the fucking point? If you knew right now with absolute certainty that you would never see your creative work put to paper by a publisher, would you give up that part of yourself completely? I asked that question because I almost did once. I gave myself a deadline. I promised that if this didn't all pan out by the time I was 30, that it was time to admit I didn't have what it took and to accept my fate. But I'm gonna let you in on a secret. I didn't almost give up. The truth is, I completely gave up. I got so sick of trying that I didn't type a single sentence for almost a year. I hated writing and everything it made me feel about myself, like a total fucking failure. Then, one day something happened to me. Something painful, and I had nowhere to turn. I sat down and I wrote it all out in a fictional place with fictional characters. I didn't do it to get published. I didn't do it with the intent of anything more than letting my voice live again. And it wasn't long before stories spilled out of me and the passion returned. I wasn't writing with a deadline anymore. I was writing because I'm a goddamn writer. I always will be. And even if everything else falls apart and I never have a published comic again, I will always write. Ryan K. Lindsay will always write. Jeremy Holt will always write. Today, we discuss why. Gentlemen, it's good to talk again.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's been the process. We'll see you next month. All right. That was perfect, man. And that set the tone because the show that we've got planned today, I think, builds all upon that. So Absolutely. We are ready. We are ready.
We are ready. And, you know, why don't we just, Jeremy, I mean, you're the next on the list. Why don't you just bring us in?
Yeah. So, that was an awesome intro. I guess we're going to be talking about the wow factor. Something that, you know, kind of inspires us to keep writing. Something that we read ourselves from fellow friends or creators or whatnot. I'm going to start. I read Jonathan Hickman's Secret, which Image put out. The artist is Ryan Bodenheim, and it is awesome. It is awesome because there were a lot of creative things that Hickman went for as far as design, as far as color, as far as just the pacing of a story. And I think we are actually going to tackle that later in the show. But it's just this really cool story about these really well-written characters. One being this guy who works at, I guess, some kind of consulting firm for securities. And there's clearly there are multiple characters and there's a big business involved. And there's people who have secrets that work for this corporation that don't want those secrets out. And they're realizing that there are people that are infiltrating their corporation. And it's really, what are you willing to pay to keep your secrets hidden? And there's this really just this great line, just great dialogue on page two, where this masked vigilante has come in, broken into this guy's house, and it's a very posh looking, nice house. And he's tied the guy up, and the guy's, you know, beaten up and bleeding from the nose. And this intruder says to him, "I think some of my least favorite things in the world are little doubts. You know what I'm talking about. Those creeping in uncertainties you have after something goes wrong. Did I lock the back door? Why didn't I check the windows? I should have bought more life insurance. It's the kind of thing that keeps you up at night, the inability to let that moment go. I swear I truly hate that. And so I do not want you to have that burden." And it's just, this was one of the first comics I've read in a while where the writing, the art, just the pacing of it all, the entire story as an issue, just, I was knocked on my ass. I was just like, this is what creator-owned comics are about, because it's, the color palette is different. It's not straightforward colors. Every panel is a different color. There is a scheme to it all, but it's, I mean, it's just really, really interesting, and I definitely really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I got to agree. I thought Secret, and it was interesting because I thought the end of it was relatively telegraphed. You could certainly see it coming, but I still didn't care. You still want to know what's going to happen next, and that's the power of a good book, I think.
I agree.
I did pick that one up, but I just haven't a chance to read it yet.
It's definitely worth it.
You'll probably like it, Kurt. It's pretty cool, and it is. It's got a nice sort of structure and set of beats to it. And have you guys been reading Hickman's The Manhattan Projects as well?
Oh, my God, yes. Yes.
Yeah, I read the first one.
I loved that issue. That was phenomenal. And I just read the second issue, actually, in preview, and it is just as good. Like, it's...
Can't wait.
It's keeping it up, which is awesome. That is... I don't know. I fell off with Hickman and his Marvel work. It just kind of lost me. And I sort of stopped caring, I guess. And with this Image stuff, he's really winning me back. It's phenomenal work.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just impressed because the amount of work he's doing, yet he has this, you know, creative force with his creator-owned comics that he still keeps things fresh. They're interesting. It doesn't feel like he's kind of like, you know, writing himself thin. This is strong. I think Manhattan Projects, I actually liked the first issue a little bit more, but both of them, I mean, just, he's one of the few writers relatively recently that I'm just excited whenever a book comes out, a creator-owned book for him. So
yeah, definitely. I'll drop my one next. My wow factor for this week is Saga. Now, that seems pretty obvious. It's the it book of the moment, Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples bringing it out of Image. But I'm picking issue two, or chapter two, as it says on the title. And I'm not even picking a moment, to be honest. The entire issue is my wow factor. It's unbelievable how ballsy this comic is, because the thing that's really coming down to me reading it at the moment is it defies genre. And I think that is, it's an amazing sort of leap to take out. The only way I could pigeonhole this book is to say it has imagination and it has it to spare. And going through the second issue, you meet this, the new bounty hunter, the Stork, I think her name is. Crazy ideas there, and I'm pretty sure amongst all the weaponry, she's holding a cowbell, and everyone knows your bounty hunters need more cowbell, so that's cool. And it just the final page, and I'm not going to say what it is, because quite honestly, if you haven't bought Saga yet, goddammit, go out and buy it and you'll figure out what I'm talking about. That last page was where it really opened up to me, and I realized these guys are going to do whatever the hell they want with this book. It's not just a fantasy book. It's not just a science fiction book. It's not just a mashup of those. It's just a story, pure and true. It is imagination. And for that, it is a book that literally wows me. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
I have a big stack of things that I have. I read the first issue, and actually I was really lucky at the Image Expo. I got to hang out with Fiona quite a bit. We just ended up chatting a lot, and I got to read kind of the pre-release before it came out. And I have read the first issue. I did buy it anyway, even though I had read it, I bought it anyway. And I have the second one on my shelf. So I'm going to be reading tonight, cause I have a bunch of stuff I'm really excited about. So yeah, it's been really great. Like I totally agree with you. It's like imagination unbridled.
It's massive. And the other thing with the second issue is, a lot of series launch with a great first issue. You've got all that lead time, you've got sort of prep time on it, and then nearly every series you dip a little bit with the second issue, and I wholeheartedly believe this series does not dip at all with the second issue.
I thought the second issue was better than the first. It was a little bit stronger because if there were Yeah, you're right.
It wasn't trying to cover so much. It was just right. easing with the narrative. It felt a bit more natural almost. Yeah, I couldn't fault it, really. I've been a Brian K. Vaughan fan for so long, and you want that new series to be really good. And so I was really hoping that I wasn't just going to be having the blinkers on and enjoying it anyway. And it's not like that. It just is a phenomenal series in every possible way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'll go into mine. And I actually hadn't had a chance to get to the store and pick this up yet, and I finally did last week. And I read the final issue of Blair Butler's Heart.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really good conclusion.
It was an amazing conclusion. And it really, at the end of issue 3, I had gone into number 4 with this expectation of how the story was going to go. And, I mean, if you haven't read it yet, I'm not going to go into spoilers, but it resolves in a way that, you know, yeah, okay, actually that's the way it should have, but it's not what I expected, especially with the title Heart. You know, you expected this great comeback and you know, you thought the story was going to go in that way, and it didn't. It totally went a different way with what Heart means. And I thought that was actually really beautiful, like really poetic end to how this whole story concluded. And it just had these last couple pages that were just so perfectly timed and so fitting to the character. And one of the things that I really liked about it, and I'm just going to read it, the very, very last page, and it's not a spoiler, but it's just a shot of his arm that has the tattoo of Unbroken, which is, it's funny because that meant something completely different in the first 3 issues. And at the very end, it means something completely different. And it says, but at the end of the day, I did what he never will. I stepped into the cage, and there's some honor in that. And I think it's actually really interesting because I feel like it ties into what we're also talking about today, that, you know, writing is such a difficult journey, and it's going to mean different things to everybody. It's going to have a different outcome to different people. And the point is that you do your absolute best and you try, just do what you can. And you know what, even if it doesn't come out the way that you had expected, you've tried. And that doesn't mean you have to stop. It just means that you've put that effort in there. And so I thought it was a really, really nice ending. And I really actually liked the character. And I totally felt that there was a great conclusion to his story arc in, like I said, a way that I hadn't expected. So, Blair, it was a great job. I really loved your series. So if she's listening,
yeah,
there you go.
I have to say the same thing. I mean, I think as soon as... I've been in love with that series ever since I read the first issue. And, you know, I was really skeptical when I first heard about it. And the first issue, you know, knocked me on my ass. And I was like, this is awesome. And I liked each issue after that. And then it was kind of – it was a weird moment for me where, for me, when it comes to, you know, committing to, like, writing and being motivated to do it, like, I believe in omens. Like, you have these moments in your life where something comes along and it reminds you that you're on the right path. And I remember I sat down. I just bought – Heart number 4 and a bunch of other comics. I went to my coffee shop, sat down, was about to read them, and I was just checking my phone. And then it said, I was about to turn the page on Heart number 4, and then I checked my phone, and it said, Blair Butler is now following you. It's like, wow, that's kind of crazy awesome. And I read the issue, and yeah, it was just one of those books where I was expecting, because I was a huge fan of the film Warrior, and I talked to her briefly about it, and you know, that's what I kind of loved about the comic book, and it went in a completely different direction. It wasn't like cookie cut. It wasn't like this big, you know, extravagant macho ending. It was like more, it was just real, and it hit home. So I really liked it.
It steered away from cliche, and that was the most powerful part.
Yeah, exactly.
I noticed all 3 of us just picked Image books, and I think that's interesting. I mean, I know we're on the Image Addiction podcast, but in no way do we sync this up ever. And it points out how well Image is doing at the moment, that they're just putting out such a great variety of books and really high quality stuff. It's not to say other publishers aren't, but Christ, I mean, people have been noticing Image a lot over the last few years, but they are really hitting. I'm surprised with the Eisners that they weren't nailing more. I was really shocked in that, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I was going to sweep them this year, so... What do you do?
I was a little surprised that they canned the nominations for best new series.
Yeah, that was kind of weird, but yeah, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, you can piss and moan about it, but I don't think that's actually going to do anything, so probably best not to.
That's what the internet's for anyway.
Well, this is true. That's all it's for. But let's go into some more positive stuff. Let's get on to the progress report. I'll start with what I've been up to. It would appear, and I don't know, I always hate saying something's about to happen and then it doesn't. You never know at the 11th hour whether something will fall over. But it appears at the moment that I've got an ongoing series greenlit at a small but recently Eisner-nominated publisher. So I'm very, very excited about that.
Congrats, man. That is amazing.
That's really great.
Yeah, cheers, guys. And I sent an email today, but I didn't get a response from him. I don't really know how much I can go into it. So, they're not announcing anything. We're still in the pre-production stages, so I can't come through with the goods just yet. But I'm super excited. It's interesting because this is not my idea. The publisher, I think I spoke about this last time, the publisher actually approached me and said, We've got this idea that has been sort of kicked in-house. We're looking for somebody to take the reins and ride it, and we thought of you. And I was very, very flattered with that, as you would be. And so we've now gone about sort of spitballing. Now, it'll be ongoing we're estimating at the moment probably 2 or 3 years. It's not an infinite title. I guess it would be a maxi series, but we're looking at sort of breaking down the story for about 2-3 years worth, and we've assembled a Bible document for the series, and we've been passing it back and forth and adding notes and discussing in the document as well as in the emails that are attached with it. And it's been an amazing process to go through that and have ideas knocked back and have other ideas built upon and build upon other ideas. I mean, as you guys probably are as well, I'm used to breaking a story on my own or with the artist. And to do it with the publisher now is totally different, but it's been really rewarding. And you start to analyze why you're sticking to your guns on certain ideas and then why other ideas won't work. And it's really awesome to put something in and just get an email back that says, yep, you've nailed it. And I don't know, have you guys ever really collaborated with someone beyond the artist on breaking a story?
I just want to ask you one quick question before we get into that.
Yeah, man.
Do you know how they kind of heard about you, or like why they came to you directly? Like, had they read your work somewhere? Had you been in talks to them before?
I've been talking to them for a while, but they had initially contacted me to pitch some things to them, and so we'd been going back and forth. And the initial way that they got onto me is the creative director there. He is really good friends with a few artists actually that I've worked with, and so he'd sort of got onto my name there. He hit me up and said, "Oh, if you've ever got any stuff, I'd like to look at it." I've shown him some of the short stories that I'm about to sort of have published this year. I've showed him some other stuff. I don't know. It opened up a bit of a dialogue there, which was very fortuitous, I must admit.
Okay, cool. I was curious because, like, yeah, they just kind of contact you, and it might be interesting for people to hear how that all happened. So it's interesting that, you know, it was through your collaboration with other artists for pitches that something has come about from that.
Yeah, yeah. So there was one guy I worked with way back when, and he's good mates with this creative director. I hate having to speak in code at the moment. It's absolutely killing me, but I don't want to sort of talk out of school. I love how you do this, Kurt. You're always really good with just being like, "Oh yeah, we're canceling a series now. I haven't announced it, but I haven't written this." I don't want to be an idiot about it. Well, not that you are, but I've said too much. I just don't want to put this guy on any sort of hot plate. But yeah, an artist that I'd worked with is good mates with this guy. So my name has been in this circle a little bit with these people. And eventually he was sort of saying, "Oh, we want to see some stuff." And we'd been back and forthing on a few different things we wanted to see land. I almost got Heist to land there. And in the end, it just didn't pan out. But as it wasn't panning out, this thing started to crop up. And so he sort of said, "Well, look, if we probably can't give you Heist, but would you like to take the ball on this ongoing?" And absolutely. And breaking down the story now, I'm trying to think of it like breaking down almost seasons of TV. We're sort of looking for the very big story. And yeah. I mean, I don't, I don't pitch really ongoings at the moment. It doesn't seem like a market where you should. I pitch ideas that can go ongoing, but I pitch self-contained minis, whereas with here we're being given a really big scope to have one shots detailed around character and to have shorter arcs, which will be really good. And it's a fairly wide ensemble cast of characters, and it's opened up really well. And finally, I got like a meter by a half a meter whiteboard, and I started like mapping things out on there. I just felt that the ideas and the scope weren't really, they certainly weren't working on the laptop screen, and I couldn't really get them on pages and having to flip back and forth. So I put everything up on this whiteboard and started to just break down all the major plot beats. And I was doing that this week, and I sent in those notes typed up into the Bible document, and I got the reply, yep, you've nailed it. We know exactly, we know the structure of where we're going. And then there's plenty of room to sort of branch out and go into little areas within it. So it's, it's just this massive idea. And I'm collaborating. The artist, I think I can say, is Daniel J. Logan, who's a guy I've worked with on a short story earlier this year. And he's also drawing the short story I'll have featured in the Oxymoron anthology from Comics Tribe.
Nice.
The guy is phenomenal. Like, hey, I just got some Oxy pages in the mail today, and they look so. His style is so unbelievably good. He's such a good storyteller, but his line work is just beautiful. And so this idea to get this ongoing with him, and we'll bring in a few sort of fill in artists to do one shots, perhaps, just so that we can sort of keep the schedule going. And I'm also interested to get a few fill in artists to meet the tone of a specific one shot for a character arc, I guess. But collaborating with Daniel has been absolutely just a dream. The guy's really nice to talk to, and his artwork certainly speaks for itself. I think this series is going to very much put him on the map. So this thing, it's taken up all my brain juice at the moment. It's been that and not a lot else, to be honest.
No, that's exciting, man. And just for the listeners out there, Jeremy and I may not have sounded like super excited, but we heard about this like last week, and it was just awesome news. And like, I've been saying this on the podcast, I've been saying it to a lot of other creators that I meet, that I really feel like 2012 is like, you know, you, Ryan, and like Jeremy, you guys are going to be making it this year. And there's already evidence kind of rolling in that direction. So congrats, man. It's a huge, huge achievement.
Yeah, cheers. It's beyond what I thought was going to be coming. And hopefully, yeah, this will put my name on the map. And I'm sort of looking forward to sinking my teeth into 2-3 years of writing this big thing. Like, it'll be good. And the publisher is up and coming. So I think it'll get some eyes on it. And the only other thing I did, and this is why I haven't done a lot else, is I finally read through my novel and made all the notes. And I was surprised to see I liked a lot of it. So I've sent it off to the publisher and said, all right, you asked for all of it. You're getting all of it. Let me know how it goes. So fingers crossed they won't forget my name all of a sudden because it's so bad.
Has you got anything else, or should we move on to one of us?
Oh, that's plenty more for me, I think. Okay. One of you guys can take it.
All right, well, I'll go into mine. It's been obviously the Emerald City Comic Con happened. And we haven't had a chance. Well, first talk about our panel.
Yeah.
Which I'll just briefly talk about. We can maybe talk a little bit later too. But the panel was really great. We had, I don't know, what do you think, Jeremy, 25 people, 30 people there?
It was like half the room.
Yeah, half the room. And a few technical difficulties. The video itself didn't play, but
no,
we still
it
had.
Didn't play.
I know, but at least the audio was there.
The audio
played. Yeah. So
so no one knows that I'm really not a redhead. This is terrible news.
Yeah, you're still a ginger, man. You're still a ginger.
I don't know where that started, but I hate that person.
it was actually pretty great because, I mean, I'll be honest, I didn't do a lot of the preparation for the show. If it had been gone my way, it basically would have been me and Jeremy blathering on and, you know, no guide, nothing to guide us through the show. So luckily my girlfriend, for whatever reason, she loves PowerPoint presentations. And she did up this really, really great guide for us. She even wrote all the notes and she sat me down to talk me through, okay, this is kind of what I'm thinking. And I'm like, yeah, this is great. And so anyway, the show was really good. It went by really smoothly. And we were really lucky to have Riley Rossimo come and kind of fill a spot in there for you, Ryan, since we couldn't have you there. And he brought a really awesome angle to the show for us where, you know, where we had a section where we talked about working with artists, how to approach artists. And he spoke about his experiences and what he looks for. And that was a really awesome opportunity. And then we just opened the floor up to some questions. And, you know, we got a lot of great questions. And, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun. I mean, Jeremy, I think you enjoyed it too.
Yeah, yeah. I like Riley's rock star entrance.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the funny part was is he 5 minutes before the show was about to go, or our panel was about to go, I realized that I had got in touch with Riley. And so I quickly ran down to the show floor. It's busy, so it's hard to get anywhere. Talk to him. I'm like, hey, man, like, are you still coming? He's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, room 102, right? I'm like, no, it's room 201. He's like, okay, but I'm only in half the show, right? So I'll come halfway through. I'm like, no, like, no. I'm like, you should be coming now. So anyway, I run back to the panel. We start doing it, and he just kind of walks in with his coffee and sits down, you know, probably like 10 minutes of the show.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But so that was really great. Emerald City was a really great experience for me. And I'm starting to find that for me, the really important parts of the show are, I mean, obviously getting in touch with fans and talking to them and connecting them and being able to thank them for supporting my work. And then it's also just the hanging out after. I mean, they're long days because you're working at the con and you're still partying and stuff like that, but you're still talking about the work. You're talking about the industry and all that kind of stuff. I also had a very important meeting on Sunday night. Now, I don't really know, again, how much I can really talk about this, but I did have a sit-down meeting with DC, and it went really well. And I'm not going to really say what has happened from that yet. Everything's still, you know, we're still talking, but that was a really amazing experience. I got to give a shout-out to Scott Snyder, who, for whatever reason, really gave me the hookup at DC. I don't really know. I'm just happy he likes my work. I'll just leave it at that. But so Emerald City was really great. It was a really great experience. And then since then, I think it was probably for about a week after Emerald City, I was exhausted, and I just hit this wall, this absolute, you know, confidence destroying wall where I could not write anything. And I mean, the sheer workload that I have right now is, I think that was part of it. I was looking at my mountain of work and I'm just like, I can't do this. I can't tackle it. And it literally a week and a half went by where I hadn't written a thing. And I just saw all these deadlines coming up. It's like, oh, Peter Panzerfaust's number 4 is almost complete and I haven't written number 5. Riley is going to be starting Debris in a few days. I haven't even written the outline for that. Alessio is caught up to me on script in Grim Reaper, and I should have gotten a script to him 2 months ago. So things were just starting to pile up. And, eventually I took a lesson learned from the process from Ryan. He talked about lists, and I'm such a dick about this to myself. I never do the list. I'm like, I always think that I'm better than the list. I'm like, I don't need a list. I need a list.
It's not a bad thing, man. It's not a bad thing. Embrace it.
No, I know. I embraced it. I embraced it. And I said, okay, because you know, if you don't do that, you really do not have a handle on everything that is expected. So I just went through and I listed every single thing. If I had an interview that had been sitting in my inbox for 2 weeks, I wrote it down. And so I just, you know, wrote everything out piece by piece. And Jeremy, I said it to Jeremy the one day, I'm like, this is what I need to have done in 2 weeks.
Oh my God. Stupid.
Yeah. So it was good because it basically allowed me to break it down in a way that I could prioritize it. And it was a visual thing that I could be like, these things are super important. I have to get these done. I have to get this paid work done because I have to buy groceries. And, you know, it was just a really great way to categorize things for me. And after that, everything just started to fall into place. I have finished Debris, number 1. I wrote that in a day. I just had this clarity that I wrote it all the way through. And interestingly enough, I used Joe Casey's method where I wrote sometimes 3 or 4 pages without any dialogue.
Yep.
In a row, just went straight through and then went back after. So I finished that. I finished the Debris outline. So I have, you know, I know exactly what's happening in all 4 issues. And I did that. I have to do the same thing for Peter Panzerfaust. But then I also got some paid work done just over the weekend here, and things are just starting to fall into place. So I finally got over my writer's block, which is really important to me. And then this is just kind of an aside. I don't know if I had got this before when we did our last show, but I got a job doing a short story with Blizzard, the people that do World of Warcraft and Diablo and all those games. And I'm doing some content for their website, which that all came about through Twitter. We just kind of messaged back and forth. He started following me, and I just said, hey, you know, how'd you get that job? I'd like that job. And he's like, well, I have a job for you. So I'm just writing. I guess there's an expansion coming out for StarCraft, and I'm writing some short stories for the website. And it's, you know, it's good pay. It's good publicity. So that is something that I'm working on this week. So it's a little bit of everything. I haven't written a short story in quite a while, actually. And I'm terrified, but I'm also looking forward to the opportunity to really, you know, stretch my skills again and try something new. So that's my progress.
Awesome. I guess I will go. So Emerald City happened. I had two pitches ready for the big show, and I basically talked to everybody that I had on my list. Thanks, Ryan. I had a list, and I spoke. Let's see. The first person I spoke to was Cena Grace at Skybound. Someone at Skybound had put up a very nice tweet about me and Ed, which was quite jaw-dropping 2 days before I left for Seattle. And I get to the booth, and the first thing Cena says to me is like, where are your pitches? Gimme, gimme, gimme. I'm like, oh, okay, that's a good sign. So I gave him my pitches, talked to him briefly about them. We had some signed release forms for them so he could officially review them. And then I tracked down Stevenson, talked to him, had a very, like, a lengthy conversation. Lengthy, like, five solid minutes, but... he looked at both of them, and Primordial, the New York period piece, he thumbed through it several times, and then he just flat out said, don't like the art. Okay. And it was really like, oh, wow, that was like a punch to my gut, because like I know how hard my artist worked on that. I know how hard I worked on that script, and I know that it's not going to have a home at Central, at Image Central. And then he looked at Cobble Hill, and he really liked it, and I fleshed out the idea a little bit more, told him about it, pitched it to him. And he stopped and he looked at me and he said, have you seen a show called Wonderfalls? I was like, I love that show. I love everything Brian Fuller writes. And he's like, he kind of smiled and he's like, wow, nobody really knows that show. I was like, well, that show actually inspired me to write Cobble Hill. And it was only on for a season, but I got the DVD set and everything. And he's like, oh, that's very cool. And he's like, yeah, I really like the art. The colors match. Every colors work with the art. And this is great. And he's like, yeah, I'll get back to you. I was like, well, okay. And then, I talked to Jim Valentino, which was, oh my God, I think I was actually sweating when I was talking to him. I was told, okay, so Tim Daniel, the production designer for Shadowline, was kind enough to do the logo design and the book design for Cobble Hill. And he made it look like $1 million. And he told me, he said, look, you need to introduce yourself to Jim. If he's in a good mood, give him the pitch. If he's not, don't. And I said, what?
Wow. Which they look exactly the same, by the way.
Yeah. So I go up to him, and he's at the Shadowline booth or the Image booth, and he's drawing, you know, on these variant covers, and he's drawing Shadowhawk. And I come up to him, I introduce myself, explain who I am in relation to Tim. And it takes him a moment to realize, and it clicks, and he's like, oh, okay. And I was like, well, you know, it was very nice meeting you. And then I was about to walk away, and he said, what's your story about? Gave him like a 2-3 sentence line pitch. And without looking up, he's still drawing. Without looking up, he says, I got the file. I'll let you know. Thank you. Very nice meeting you. And I just walked off. I was like, oh my God. And I talked to Tim later about it. And Tim's like, hey, as long as he didn't brush you off, that's still good. I was like, oh, okay. And then I had a really, really informative conversation with Charlie Chiodoni. And I was trying to find him, and he was never at the Oni booth. So it's like I kept missing him. And then my artist Selena wandered off, and I lost her for a moment. And then I had to get to the panel. So I get to the panel, and she's sitting outside the room. I was like, oh, hey, there you are. She's like, yeah, I met Charlie Chu at Oni, and my friend is an intern there. So she introduced us, and he knows you. It's like, what do you mean? Oh, well, yeah, I know Charlie. She's like, no, like I gave him the pitch. And he's like, oh, Jeremy Holt, he pitches a lot. He's like, yeah, and he's like, oh, and you got Ed Briston on letters. That's awesome. And Ed, yes, I know this is going to be another episode where you've been mentioned. I know it's Unbroken. Oh, yeah. But so he said, I really like the art. And he said, why don't you send your portfolio as well and send this in a PDF? So I finally touched base with Charlie, and he's like, look, I'm going to be honest. Like, even if I want to print this book today, like our publishing schedule is so booked Like, we're talking like a couple years. He says, so what I would recommend, because look, you can keep sending me stuff and I know you and I like you and I will read your everything you send me. But it would be in your best interest to just continue working, get something done, finish a mini series, finish an issue, whatever you got to do, and post it online if you have to, print it if you have to. But it will make it easier for me when I'm ready to start filling spots to be like, he's already done. He's got the stuff in the bag and it's ready to go. So I thought about that and I realized that I guess the biggest progress for me this year is that, you know, I was giving myself a 5-year goal. And I realized, you know, everybody's like, well, what are you going to do after 5 years? Are you just going to quit? I was like, no. I'm like, then what? It just seems like an arbitrary goal. What are you going to do after 5 years? And I realized my shift now is I'm pretty much done pitching, I've realized. I think what I'm going to do now is with the artists that I'm working with three different artists now on different projects that I haven't even seen the light of day. And I'm going to just talk to them about, you know, slowly progressing through and just finishing maybe an issue or two. Because I realized at this point in my career, I need to like get a table at a con. I need to start selling something. And I can't sell my pitches to anybody. Nobody will buy them. But I think if I can get a full issue done, that would be a good stepping stone to, you know, gaining awareness on the book and or whatever book it is. And like I've decided I'm going to finish the first issue of Cobble Hill and Selena's on board. So I got to take advantage of that. And that's what I realized for moving forward after the 5th year is that I'm just going to start finishing things because that's really what I need to be doing at this point. Outside of that, progress is going on with Lucid Proof, which was a pitch I had done late last year. I actually had to fire an artist. It was very, very cordial. Had a conversation with Vic Malhotra, the artist, and he was okay with it because he was not budgeting his time and he owned up to it. And he's like, I need to get better at that. He says, move forward with whoever you want. And so I've been working with Ariel Zuckerbrohl, which is looking awesome. I actually have a meeting with them tomorrow or maybe Tuesday to see more pages. And then I'm working on a project with W. Scott Forbes, which has really been interesting because it's a story that he came up with. It's a story he could not write himself. He tried several times and he couldn't do it. So I wrote 6 pages and sent it to him. And he actually had a lot of notes and it was very different because I had to take a back seat. I was like, I had to be completely open. And it took me like a good solid 30 minutes to talk to him about getting the idea down. I was like, you're saying a lot of ideas all at once. And I like all of them, but it needs to be a little bit more cohesive. And we need to figure out what we're trying to tell with the story. So that was a real learning experience, but it is going well. And then, you know, as soon as I got back from Seattle, I was actually writing Cobble Hill, the first issue on the plane. And I've finished the first issue. I did the Joe Casey method, finished the first issue without dialogue. The day after I got back from Seattle. And then I finished it by like 2 or 3 days later with the dialogue, which actually took me a while, but, yeah, so that's my progress.
I'm excited to hear about you sort of self-publishing, man. I got to admit this is, I don't know. It feels inspirational. I really dig it, man.
Yeah. And you know, that is one avenue. I mean, there is progress being made at the publishers that I mentioned. I've gotten a couple emails from 2 publishers and one of them, it's actually moving up the chain of command. So some big people are looking at it and it's basically down to one guy who has to say yes. But a smaller press publisher reached out to me and let me know that they received the pitch and that they the publisher immediately sent me an email saying that he had sent it to his publishing partner. So that seemed positive, and he said he was going to get back to me. So, yeah, I mean, regardless of what happens, I'm just going to keep working on the book because, you know, our goal is to have it ready for Fan Expo in Toronto. So Selena has a table there, so it's just perfect. I already have a press badge pre-approved from last year, so I'm just going to go and have the first issue. And, you know, if people like it, say, hey, you know, the second issue is coming out soon, which, you know, whenever that might be, I have no idea, but at least – you know, people have the illusion that the book is going, so.
I mean, there are books coming out of Image and other things that their second issue isn't the next month. I think people will deal with it.
Yeah. So.
But I think putting it online as well, when we talked to Brandon Seaford, he talked about putting his Witch Doctor stuff online and look how that worked out for him and Witch Doctor. So
Yeah. And that's actually what he told me when I met him. Well, I mean, I've gotten to know him and hung out with him a lot over the weekend, which was great. And he told me, he's like, look, I've been thinking a lot about your pitch and I got to look at it. And he says, you need to do more. We did 16 pages of Witch Doctor. And when we actually started getting traction with it, we had 4 publishers knocking on our door. And I was like, okay. And he's like, just do more, like finish an issue or whatever, but just have more because I think there's more to tell with that story. And I had this great moment with him where we were at the hotel bar at the Sheraton, and he was with some people, and I went over to say hi to him, and he just introduced me. And he says, you know, I've realized that I always thought of myself as the writer that never got published, and then I finally did. So the man right here, Jeremy Holt, I'm passing the torch on to him because that's where I was. And everyone's like, oh, nice to meet you. I'm like, oh, what? What is going on? Okay, thank you so much, Brandon. You're awesome. Yeah, so.
All right, we're already at 40 minutes here, boys. We ramble on. Let's go on to the let's go on to the grill'em. So we have a question from Jason on Facebook. I've kind of summarized it here a bit, but it's one thing to have a good review or a mean review, but what about a truly critical one? What piece of critical advice or observation have changed your writing, made you notice that something you then improved, gentlemen?
I got to say, with this one, I write a lot, but I also write reviews. And so I totally dig where this question is coming from. I think this is a brilliant question. And I know when I write reviews, good or bad, I hopefully never write a mean review. And I just this week read Rich Johnston's Iron Muslim. That was not a fantastic book. And so I had to find a way to really critically analyze that book without just being a dick about it. And it's interesting to come from that side of the fence. But I mean, what we want to talk about, I guess, is people critiquing our work. Now, I suppose Jeremy and I, we haven't really had work out there to be reviewed online per se, but we've certainly received notes from people. And I think the biggest lesson you've got to take is that when someone gives you notes that are not positive, do not just get your back up. You can't just sort of be, oh, well, you're wrong. And you'd be surprised how much that is a bit of an instinctual thing, especially for something you've put a lot of hard work into and a lot of heart and a lot of brain into. When somebody says, hey, this thing here doesn't work, or sometimes the notes will just come back and be like, I don't like this thing, and that's not even critical, but you cannot just sort of shrug it off and be like, well, you're wrong, or but have you thought about it this way? Like, you cannot push it. There needs to be yield. And I've found that out twice this year. One was with my Oxymoron short story, where Tyler James, the publisher of Comics Tribe, was editing it. And he sent me back a note and was just like, oh, I want you to sort of change the end. And I sort of emailed back a little bit. I was like, oh, I like where it's going, though. And he nailed it. He was like, it is. It's a great idea, but we're not going to be able to nail it in 8 pages. So how about we explore a different avenue? He helped scaffold one with me, and it came through super strong. And you sort of have to take that on the chin. And in spitballing this new series that I'm working on now, plenty of things have come back where they've just sort of said, I hate this character, can we just scrap them? Or what is the purpose of this person? Or how is this happening logically? And you have to support your arguments for what's happening. And I think it's really important to do take it on board, and do not write your email reply within 30 minutes. Let it soak in, let it percolate, and think to yourself, all right, where are they coming from? Can I see from their point of view? If you can, well, there might be a problem. If perchance they are wrong, which is a really loaded word to use, wrong, go delicately about it. Everybody just wants the best product. No one's out to slam your work on a personal level. And if they are, stop sending it to them. But it's everybody wants the best from something. And so I think you've got to have that thick skin, but you've also got to be able to see things from two sides, which can be really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just chime in and completely agree with that. I was just digging through my email, and this reminded me of a conversation I had with an editor at IDW where I was submitting back and forth, or getting notes back and forth about the first issue of the first graphic novel I wrote. And he wrote this to me, which I think kind of speaks to what you were just saying, Ryan. He said, first off, apologies for being as blunt as I am here. It's a great achievement putting together a complete issue like this, and you should be really proud of it. I know firsthand how much effort that takes to do this with no outside financial support. I also know how hard it is to put your stuff out there for criticism, and I really applaud you for both the energy and effort you put into this, as well as the cordial demeanor you've shown in trying to share it. When I don't see any potential at all in someone, I usually just say, cool, not bad, and be done with it. It's obvious that you have determination and commitment. Those types of people I like to reward with honest feedback, which is what the above is. It should go without saying that it's just my opinion. Someone else may have a completely different take on it. So really, you just have to this is how I've always looked at it. Like, I'm not the best at writing comic books. If I was, you know, then I wouldn't be in the position I am. And even if I was, I wouldn't like to think that, because that's when you feel like there's nothing else to accomplish. Like, you've climbed the mountain and that's it.
Yeah.
I think you can always get better. And I think that, you know, taking advice well, taking criticism well, I mean, if an editor is willing to write you a lengthy email, which this one did, he wrote me several emails over the course of about a year and a half, and it was basically a blueprint of notes on how to write a good comic book. And I couldn't just throw that away because he didn't like it. I mean, he was nice enough to go in depth on why he didn't like it and what he thought could have been better about it. And if you can get those notes from editors, because it's so much easier for them to just say, nope, don't like it, cool, not bad, whatever. And if you can actually get a lengthy response, like, that's like another tool in your belt. And that's just how you have to – that's my approach anyway. So
I had – this is – I guess there's two examples of this. I got a critique from – when I sent my novel in, I think it was about 4 years ago, I actually got a response from the head editor at Del Rey, which was I felt was actually a pretty big deal that it even got that far. And she sent the package back, the whole – document back to me, and with a note that basically said, your writing is, she said, this is really good, but there's a few things that you really need to work on. And I felt it was very justified. She said, your writing is too left foot, right foot. And what she meant by that is you over explain each action, you know, rather than saying, you know, Bob drank from a cup, you know, it's like Bob took the cup, he put water in it, he brought it to his lips, he drank the water. You know, yeah. Like, that's what I was doing as an example. I was over-explaining things where I wasn't letting the reader fill in the gaps for themselves. And then also, I had the same kind of edit when Snow Angel, years ago, I was working with Arcana's editor. And there was a couple of scenes where he's like, you know, you're putting too many panels in. You need to let the reader fill those in with their imagination and see how, you know, the character got from here to here. And I realized that there was a sequence where Angela was in her bedroom, and she basically sneaks into the living room where her father's sleeping, grabs his keys and steals the car. But literally it was like, she opens the door, she looks out of the door, she's walking across the living room. She's reaching into the coat. She pulls out the keys. She looks at the keys. That was just an example of my inexperience. And he's just like, you know, there's seven panels on this page. It needs to be two. Yeah. And I really learned from that. And I was kind of like, I think it's always hard to hear criticism about, you know, how, you know, you have weaknesses in your writing, but that I was always so scared that, you know, it wasn't being clear enough that, you know, oh, the reader's not going to be able to know what I'm doing here. And it's like, no, they can figure out a lot. They're, you know, they're a lot smarter than I am. And so they'll be able to figure this out on their own. And I've learned that was a huge part of fixing my writing, was learning that, you know, keep it simple and allow the, you know, what happens in between the panels, the reader can fill those gaps in themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to just say, just to save some time, I think we can totally segue what we're saying into the process, which is about pacing. And I think that it just reminded me of where I had a read through with Selena through the first issue of Cobble Hill, and something that I don't do, like I am very articulate when it comes to speaking, and even when I write, I do that. So when she read it, she had a lot of notes, and most of them were like, this does not sound like a 15-year-old boy. This sounds like a college-age man. Like, he doesn't sound like he's in high school. And that was really helpful for me, because I will reread scripts, but I miss that sometimes because I'm so used to, I know how I speak. So it's really helpful to have your artist or have a second pair of eyes read a script just so they understand, okay, this is what you're going for. This is what you've written. This is what I don't understand. So
I'm wondering, on the flip side, do you guys read scripts of other people and then give them critiques? And how do you feel giving those critiques?
I've never done it.
No. I think I've done it. I think I've done it a few times. Like, you guys have sent me stuff and I've read them and I've given advice like where I can. I try not to be like, because you have to also respect the story that the person is telling. Like, it's very – sometimes you have to be very careful not to be like, oh, I totally wouldn't go that direction with the story. I would go this way. Keep that in check, but be more critical of maybe the pacing. which is what we're going to talk to in the process next. But that's always something you have to be very careful of, because, you know, you are going to interpret the story your own way. That doesn't mean it's the right way.
Right. You have to have a completely objective view, I think. You know, the people that have read my scripts and given me edits, and I think Curtis does it well as well, is that you say, okay, you pose questions like, well, you were going, or I don't quite understand what you're trying to say with this. Not that is wrong or that makes no sense, because I mean, you didn't write it, so you can't say what's right or wrong.
Right.
One of my favorite notes actually came from you, Kurt, where I'd sent it to you and you messaged back and you said, this is good, but it's not your best. Read it again and you'll know why. And that was all it said. I was like, nice. And I did. I read it again. I was like, yeah, kid's got a point. Nice work. But I find when I'll read scripts for other people sometimes, and I always make sure that I point out what I do like in there, because they have to. If you just start saying, oh, these things are bad, well, the person might start thinking everything's bad. They need to know what not to change, or at least what you don't feel they should change or work on. But I don't know. I've always got constructive criticism, and so I really try and sort of couch it in like, I'm not trying to be a dick and you've asked for my feedback, but, you know, take it with a grain of salt. And I always feel like I try to not sugarcoat it. I'm relatively straightforward, but just couch it a little bit in like, this isn't me judging you as a person. This is me saying, here's how I think that this could work better. And I mean, I had a friend a while ago that I was going back years that I would critique scripts that he would send through. And he eventually just stopped sending them through. And not because I was a negative Nelly, but I would ask hard questions. And one of them was he was doing the Robin Hood story. And I just sort of said to him, why is a Robin Hood story going to sell? Is there anything that you are bringing to this that makes it more than just the Robin Hood story we've seen a million times? And not that you'd suddenly twist it and he's an alien, but why is this your passion sort of thing? And I really don't think he appreciated me asking that, to be honest. But I thought it was a really serious question, because shit, I've seen that Robin Hood story a lot. Can you tell me why a publisher will want to pick this up when there are millions of real life stories? What are you, I mean, you look at The Secret History of D.B. Cooper that's just come out of Oni that Brian Truller is doing. He's twisting that and he's making it something different. You need to not necessarily insert new themes to the story, but find a reason why anyone wants to read it again.
What I think that you've touched upon, which I think we can segue into the pacing, is about how to pitch something. As far as pacing, you know, because when you are pitching, you only have X amount of pages, like 5 to 6 pages. That's all they really want to see, depending on the publisher. Image specifically wants that. And, you know, this note that you made, Curtis, about how should a comic script be paced? Page turn, splash pages, paneling. Something that I realized this week was that there's a method that I really like that Curtis uses when it comes to pitching a 5 to 6 page pitch, is to have this big splash at the end of the pitch to kind of hook them in, because, you know, you're trying to hook somebody into a story that they've never heard about. They don't even know who you are. And I got an interesting note from Joshua Williamson when he read Cobble Hill, and he said, why isn't there a big crazy splash or reveal or action on page one? He says page one opens pretty slow. And I thought about that and I was like, well, you know, that's actually what I intended, because I wanted the hook to be at the end, not the beginning. And when I read Secret, there's a big crazy opening scene on the first page. And then I thought, well, I think that it's different. I think it's different for your experience. I think it's different for how many books you have under your belt, because I think from someone in my position, I think the splash page at the end and the hook at the end rather than at the beginning, I think works to my favor, because I can't assume that they're interested in the first page. So it was just something, it was an interesting insight that I was thinking about today, because, you know, Josh gave me a contradicting critique to what I'm used to as far as pitching, but I don't know.
I was just going to say we should probably segue into the next one, because, again, we've still got 3 more things to do yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's basically what I'm talking about as far as the process of this whole show is talking about the pacing. And, you know, I don't know, Kurt, how you decided to do the pacing the way you've done it. But, like, if you read Secret, there's this major splash page on page 6 where it reads kind of like a TV show where there's an opener and there's this title splash page, and then you go into, which works really well because I like Hickman and I will read all his books. But if I was to try to do that, they're like, why is this empty filler here? So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Writing for pitch just feels like a different beast sometimes. I mean, you're picking your best scene, but it can't just be the best scene. It's got to be the scene that encapsulates the theme and the tone and the content and the characters. Like, it's almost lightning in a bottle. And I think it's a short sort of, you've got about five pages, I guess, but trying to find that sweet spot. I don't know if there's any prescriptive formula to it, but it's got to work for the story, I guess.
Yeah, I think, so I don't know. We kind of segued over into the process already, so we are talking about pacing. But someone commented to me on Twitter that they wanted to hear more about the scripting process. And you know, it is different between pitching like a pitch comic and the actual comic itself. One of the common things is a page turner. When you do a page turn, it's basically like your odd pages are the page that you flip. And you always want to have these little kind of like mini cliffhangers, essentially, that it basically is like, oh, you know, it's you just want them to keep turning. And that's something that you really have to develop into your style. And they can be really subtle. You know, they can be really subtle, like your life. If let's say there's a murder sequence happening, you have the person creeping into the room, and the last panel before you turn the page is the person turning last second and being like, you know, oh shit, you flip the page, and then, you know, you can hit them with a splash, or you can hit them, you know, with an interesting paneling. You know, obviously with a pitch, you want to do that as well. You want to have, you know, if you're doing a five page, well, I mean, it's always nice if you can get a six page, but you have your fifth page be like a lead up to that build, and then you just nail them with that last page. I don't know. How about you guys? Like, when you guys are writing your scripts, what's like important for your pacing? Do you find, is it the dialogue or is it the body language? What are the things that are you really want to hit on those pages?
I think it's everything.
It's a mixture of plot, beat, and dialogue, I reckon.
Yeah, I just think that the six page splash, I think, works in the favor of a pitch because that's all you get. Now, if I was doing a full comic book, I probably wouldn't rely on the six page splash. I would rely on a big opener. I just think that, you know, it's two different mindsets when it comes to writing a full issue, which if you're going to do that, then you're not trying to pitch to a publisher. You're just going to write it the way you want to write it, and you're going to pace it the way you want to pace it. But with a pitch, you got to have some, because that was the biggest thing. The fault I had when I was pitching was that I was ending things in the middle of a scene. And that's the first thing Curtis said on one of my pitches. He's like, this ends in the middle of a scene, and it doesn't make me want to turn the page because I feel like I'm catching half of a conversation. And that's because I was writing a full issue. I wasn't writing a pitch. So it just depends on what you want to do with your story. If you're going to pitch it, or if you're going to self-publish, I think it really is important to figure out what you're going to do. What is your end goal? Do you want to get picked up by a publisher, or do you just want to make it regardless?
Yeah. And that really delineates how it's going to flow and whether it's got that standalone boom at the end. Do you want more, or whether it's just a bit of, here's some of the story, whether it's like a snapshot, an excerpt. Thinking about the page turns, the way I sort of think of it is at the end of the two pages, you want to give a bit of a promise or something to come. And then when they turn in that top left, or it's a splash or whatever, when they turn the page, there needs to be a reward for that. And you can't have that with every page turn. Unfortunately, sometimes you're going to turn the page and start a new scene. But every now and then, I think if you can set it up, like with the oxymoron short that I'm writing, on one of the pages, the oxymoron is doing a little sort of lap dance bump and grind on this guy. He's tied to a chair, and it builds and builds. And when you turn the page, you damn well get a climax. So you want that sort of build and beat. And I specifically tailored that onto the page. And you can get that sometimes. If you can get it every time, goddamn, hats off to you. But sometimes, one thing I've noticed, I think Rick Remender and Scott Snyder both do really well, is they will end a scene and start a new scene on the other, the page turn, but they'll have the dialogue bracket across. So at the end of the page, someone will start saying something, and you can see they're sort of saying half of something, and then the other half comes on the page turn. So you get the end of what they're saying, which is a bit of a reward. It's a bit of a punch, and they often tie what they're saying into the start of the next scene. So everything sort of thematically flows. It's trope you see definitely around. It's nothing new, but when used really well, damn, it can be powerful.
Actually, speaking of pacing, I thought this would be kind of funny to bring up. I met Nick Spencer at Image Expo, and one of the things I got a lot of critique from like people who read Peter Pan's Across number one, it was I totally shit canned the splash on the very last page, and that is an example of a failed page turn there. What I had in mind what it needed to be, and I thought it was like this really great conclusion to the story. But the problem is that I hadn't set up the previous page to give that splash kind of a sense of place. And I think that's why it led to a lot of confusion. So Nick Spencer said to me, he's like, Curtis, he's like, man, I love Peter Panzerfaust. And then he kind of went quiet. And he's like, but that ending, he's like, he just shook his head. He's like, you didn't do it. You didn't nail it. And I was like, I know. I said, I know. And it's funny because then I followed up with him at Emerald City, and I kind of went over to him and we just kind of had this moment. I'm like, so did you read Peter Panzerfaust 2? He's like, I did. And I'm like, how was that ending? He just kind of nodded. He's like, you got it. Nice. So, you know, you have to be really careful, and that's what it is. Like, it's the lead up. And just because I know what it means in the story, you have to be very aware of, does the reader know when they flip that page, what the setup and what the payoff is? If they don't, you have fucking failed. And I did. Peter Pan's Across 1, I mean, I still feel like some people got it and they understood what I was doing with it. But one of the things that I realized is that some people didn't know that Peter Panzerfaust was the Peter Pan story. So when they got to that last page, they were just like, what?
That's
so they didn't, weird. They didn't get that. It was like the nod to him crowing. And some people, this is the best part, is people thought he was sneezing. So it was just really bizarre. You know, to a lot of different people, they're like, they just didn't know what was happening. So, you know, that's an example of it wasn't clear to a lot of readers what happened. And it was because the buildup wasn't done properly. And the payoff, even though it was clear to me, wasn't clear to a lot of people. So you just have to be really aware of what it is you're doing and make sure that the buildup, you know, leads to the final payoff, especially when it's the last, you know, the last page of the issue. That is probably the most important one because, you know, that can make or break you. You know, luckily it got enough good buzz that people still followed through with it. But I mean, if it had just been like a title that no one really talked about, that could have killed the entire series for me. So I feel lucky in a lot of ways that, you know, I still have people reading it, but just be very careful. That last page can make or break your book.
I want to know who thought he was sneezing. That's awesome.
There was a review on Comics Bulletin.
Yeah.
And there was another one. I can't remember where it was, but yeah. And then actually in a podcast too, it was actually in a few places that people said, and even when I was at Image Expo, they're like, yeah, I didn't really get the sneeze. And I'm like,
It's like a real David Lynch thing you put in there. And then he sneezes. Get it?
It'll take, read it again. You'll figure it out eventually.
I could just see someone in a cafe throwing it down. Jesus Christ, this kid sneezes and credits. I call foul.
The audacity. Anyways.
Can I say, we don't have all the answers for how to pace a script, but I can direct everybody on where to find those answers. It's a book called Lock and Key. Have you guys read that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I just got all caught up on Lock and Key, and Christ, Joe Hill puts in an example of everything that you should do if you want to make good comics. He uses splash pages perfectly. He panels his pages just right. He uses dialogue. Oh, that comic has turned my life around. It is genius. I am an absolute sort of convert. It is in my top 10 all time easily.
I mean, he's getting a lot of accolades and it's deserved. And I agree with you. I got the first trade when I did my signing in Maryland and read on the plane and, you know, I've been reading it here at home and the first trade is all you get like this, bam, you know what the story is about, you get this kind of gritty violence. And then it's just like, it's just this slow build and you can see where it's coming and there's more there. And it's just this really beautifully paced book. And I agree with you.
Yeah. I read like they had a sale on Comixology. So I read like the five trades worth and man, it just gets better. And he's always trying different things. It's, listeners, if you haven't checked out Lock and Key, take it on my stamp of approval, which means so much. Go out and get Lock and Key. It is genius. And I don't use that word lightly. It is genius.
All right. Well, let's move on to the roundtable. And this kind of ties into my intro a little bit.
Yes.
So the roundtable, we're going to talk about write because you have to. When a pitch is rejected and it seems no print publisher will take your comic, there are other options out there. And what I really want to talk about is, you know, we're all writers. And anybody listening to this show, we all have the bug. It's something that we have to do, whether it's just for our own private, you know, just so we can get words out and get our feelings out on the page, if it's only us whoever reads it, or, you know, if we have published work or if we're trying to get published, we're all writers. And I think at the end of the day, no matter how frustrating it is and, you know, how much shit we have to go through just to get these stories out there, we want to write. And you may give up on it, but I think at the end of the day, you'll always will come back to it. And, you know, I've had conversations with Jeremy. I've had conversations with Ryan and other people who have experienced frustrations or and there is just kind of even talk amongst the creator, you know, like in independent comics, like me and Jim Zub and Charles Soule. And a lot of people are just talking about what we as creators can do, because, you know, even if you get published with Image Comics, there's no guarantees. There's no guarantee that you'll get another one. There's no guarantee that your book will even sell and you may go broke trying to get it out there. There's a lot of realities about it, but there are other options. And that's what we're going to talk about. So I'm just going to open it up. You guys, what do you think about this topic?
I think it's a real commitment of your time and your money, and you can't go half-assed into this. And I think there are some creators that sort of, they go into a pitch and they get their 5 pages of art drawn up by somebody and they've got an idea of this story that they're going to tell. And when it doesn't land, that it doesn't land anywhere, that concept of walking away from that story can be really hard. And I mean, there's reasons for doing it. Maybe you finally, after all that hard work and it not landing anywhere, you look at it and you say, that story, yeah, they're right. It doesn't work. And so maybe you need to walk away from that story. I mean, not every story you come up with is going to be a perler. Like, there's going to be some shit dredging through, and it'll take you a while to notice it sometimes. But there are some stories where I hope listeners and us as well, if we're writing them, if just because somebody else doesn't want to back it, you've got to be really passionate about that story. And so I think digital is a really big model to push with, and it's not something you're probably going to make any money off. But I don't know, if my writing hasn't paid my mortgage really yet, so I've survived this far. I don't want to go another 30 years not getting paid for it, but you need to start giving the writing community the promise that you are committed, I guess. And once you agree internally to go forward with it, I guess it's just a matter of, I don't know, do you see it as like print versus digital? Do you reckon that's the big divide
I don't really look at it that way, because I think those options are at your disposal regardless of what you do. I look at it this way. Like, you have to decide on what you want to accomplish. Do you want to get do you want someone to back and believe in your project, or do you just want to make the project regardless? Because they take two very different muscles. To put together a pitch, you have to, you know, do the normal thing of getting the art done, writing the story, obviously. But you have to put a pitch together. You have to go to the conventions. You have to do all these things that, if you're just creating issues and you're just putting them online, you don't really have to make that time commitment and that financial commitment of showing your face at shows. But that's something that I decided at the beginning, was I wanted to get picked up by somebody. I wanted someone to take a chance on me. Now, that's a huge mountain to climb, but I've realized that that is a completely different way about going about it than just getting comic books made. Because I think if I was just getting comic books made, I wouldn't spend all the time going to conventions. I wouldn't spend all the time networking. I would just make comic books and, you know, do what I had to get them out there, but just focus on just getting them out there, like finishing them. So I think that, you know, it's really, you have to decide before you even start what the first hurdle is to complete a comic book series or get published by one. And I think that, you know, those can cross down the road. Like, if you have something made, like Ed Brisson's a prime example. He's done a really great series of comic books called Murder Book, and that gave him enough recognition in front of the people that he wanted to be recognized by to, you know, open up avenues. But yeah, that's my take.
Yeah, that's definitely a commitment.
I mean, that was something that I considered too. And actually, I had Tyler Jenkins, who I did Peter Pounds Across with, we actually did our own narrative magazine. And maybe I've talked a bit about it before, but essentially it was just like we were doing everything in there, like anything that told a story, we would put in our magazine. And we didn't really dick around with it. It was like we did full-on production, magazine style. It cost a lot of money to do. But there was things in that magazine that, you know, I put pieces in for it, like short stories and short comics and stuff like that. And we even used that as, like, promotional stuff for our own work. We invested a lot of money in that. And it was something that, A, it got us telling stories when, you know, sometimes they don't have the time, or, you know, like, especially for artists, it's harder for them because some of them, that's their day job, so they can't just commit free time to doing just what they want to do. But it gave us a focus, and it gave us a real drive and reason to actually get stories made. And I mean, I learned a lot just even about my own craft in that time. And I think
there's a real value in doing, Jeremy, what you're doing. You, like you said, if Cowboy Hell doesn't get picked up, you're just going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And you are doing it anyway. You've already written the script, and it's, I think it's going to be to your benefit, even if nothing happens with it, even if you put it out digitally and nobody buys it. I mean, I'm not saying that's the case, but if it does, you'll have finished, you know, your 4 or 5 issues series. You'll have written a beginning, you'll have written a middle and an end. When you get caught up in that production cycle of pitch 5 pages, write the summaries, pitch 5 pages, write the summaries, you're not getting the full writing experience because you're not doing it from beginning to end. So I think there's value in, again, even if nobody even does the art for it, why not just write the whole series out and have it ready in case an artist is willing to do it, or, you know, it gets picked up. It's just a great writing exercise. And there are lots of options out there. There are, you know, communities on the web. I mean, web comics are difficult because there's so many out there, but there are communities that are looking for new content that have a built-in viewership. And Keenspot is one of them. They have quite a lot of webcomics on there, but they have so many viewers already from 10 years of being in the market that you're going to get a lot of eyes. So you can find those places and be like, hey, I've got an idea, pitch it to them, and just release it digitally. Find a place to build up your name, and you go that route, and maybe in the end you will get the print that you've been looking for, or maybe by then you'll have your own little empire. Who knows? There's lots of ways to tell your stories. Don't give up because you just can't get them printed.
Yeah. I mean, Jeremy and I have been in the same boat. We're pitching and pitching, and I mean, you want to land somewhere, but I also want to tell stories, man. I want to write. And when you're in that pitching cycle, you know what you write more than anything? Goddamn synopsis charts and one paragraph pitches of your document. That's not what I want to do. I don't want to sit around and write, here's the summary of my idea. I want to write out my idea. The only reason I want to tell a story is because I goddamn fall in love with those characters. And I see that world, and it just itches within you. It truly does. And sitting around writing pitches is so – I mean, it has to be done, and I respect that. But it can be mind-numbing at times, and it's a good skill to build. But then it's the skill I'm going to build to get to the point where I'm going to use the real skill I want to use, which is telling the story. And You should be able to boil your story down. You should be able to condense themes and content. But I'm a writer because I like writing stories. And whether it's in comic, short story, novel, anything like that, it's the story that hooks me. It's not the process of pitching. Imagine being in love with the process of pitching. Like, that'd be a terrible existence. It's something that can be fun, but I'm going to be honest, it's a stepping stone. It's, why would you pitch if you didn't want to get picked up, really? And that end goal, and eventually, I mean, and I'm going to discuss it a bit in my close, but I want to tell those stories. And so I'm sort of looking at that idea of people who get their novels and just turn them into e-publishing documents and sell them for 99 cents on bloody Amazon. Giddy up, like, go for it. Are you going to be lost in a sea of content? Yeah, probably, but it'll be out there and it'll show you can do some stuff. At the moment, I would be really worried if a publisher looked at me and said, all right, you know how to write little 5-page pitch scripts, and that's about it. I want them to see that I can do a bunch of other stuff. I was talking to Cena Grace at Skybound the other day, and he said, what we're looking for, Ryan, is people who are as passionate about comics as Robert Kirkman was a decade ago. And I was like, well, that's the niche I certainly feel that I feel, and I will continue to show you how. And I'm going to keep sending different things his way, things that I'm getting published. And it's not necessarily going to get me picked up, but I want to show that there's enthusiasm for the storytelling, not just for, I don't know, I would love to land an image, but if it's not going to happen, some of these stories I'm so committed to, I want to take them further. And I don't know, it's going to be a big step when I cross that divide to see exactly how I'm taking that further, as to whether it'll be printing off an issue or I don't know.
I mean, pitching is something that every writer who wants to break into comics should really seriously attempt and, you know, build those muscles. Mm. But you guys are saying, I feel like, you know, there is an emptiness to it, and you know, I'm not completing anything, and you know, publishers now, it's harder to break in because they want to know that they can sell whatever you're pitching them. And if you can pitch them a whole series, that's so much easier to sell than, oh, we have six pages and it's work in progress. And I can see the validity in completing books. I can see the validity in, you know, completing things without someone's say. And that, you know, that is what I've realized, is that I'm kind of done pitching, because people know who I am. I have my face out there. I'm not interested in pitching ideas anymore. I'm interested in showing stories. And, you know, you need to just finish stories. And yeah, I want to keep writing, and I want to, you know, I've only ever finished one story or one series I've ever written. It was a 5-issue thing that is still work in progress, but I'd like to have more of those, just a chest full of drawers with papers and scripts. And that's what Stephen Isles did. I mean, he had tons of ideas and nobody wanted to publish them. And then when they did, he was just emptying drawers, and that's what I should do. So,
yeah. I don't know.
How are you going? Good, I think.
it's a massive topic, and I think there's so much more for us to go into, and it depends on each person. And I hope there are listeners out there that are thinking about their path and putting together a plan, maybe even putting that plan on a list, who knows, and thinking about, all right, am I going to get to a point where I'll self-publish something? Because otherwise, I don't know, I hate throwing away a story that I've worked hard on, and I like those characters. Do something with it. Maybe don't invest in paying an artist to draw the 6 issues, because you don't want to run into the red on these things, but, or at least not too far into them. Do something with them. Throw them up online. Give them away for free. You weren't going to make any money from it anyway. Pass it around. I don't know. It's a tough one. But
definitely.
I guess that'll close us up then, lads. Any other last thoughts on that?
No.
Yeah. I think it would be.
It's almost been a downer to end on. Don't worry, guys. I'll take us lower. It's all good.
Yeah, you know, those topics that you're right. It would like fill up another show, I think. And it's a big topic. Oh. It is.
And it could change on your daily mood. It'll change on where you are in the year. That's why we're not giving answers on that one. That's for sure. We're not telling any listeners what to do. You've got to assess where you are. But ladies and gentlemen, that has been The Process, and we'd like to thank the Image Addiction Podcast Network for hosting us. As always, we'd love to thank the listeners. You guys really come out in force, and I'm stoked I couldn't make the panel. But no, even though I couldn't make the panel, I'm stoked that people turned up and there's support for what we're doing, and it's really good. And so to wrap up this theme of what this entire podcast has been, and there's been a nice through line if you've been listening close enough, I want to wrap it up by saying, guys, you're going to have to work for free. And you know what? You're going to have to love it, quite honestly. If you think of the titans of the industry right now, they all worked on amazingly small books when they were starting off, and the odds are you probably still haven't even read them. You may have, but you may not. Now, Fraction, over at Marvel, just ran an event not that long ago. He started on Rex Mantooth, the Spy Gorilla. I don't know a lot of people that have read that, to be honest. I have. I managed to track some copies down, and I'm not saying that in some sort of hipster, oh, I've read more than you, but he did this in obscurity. That's the point. He was working well for free. I mean, shit, he did Casanova for 2 years at Image, and he says he barely got paid a cent for doing that. But he did it out of love. He had a column on CBR. That's near enough for free. You're going to have to work for free, guys. I mean, look at Brubaker. He did the Low Life cartoons. Bendis was making these weird Fumetti stories and underground commentary. I mean, shit, even Kurt here wrote Beautiful Creatures, listeners. Hands up who's actually read it. Sometimes, and that's not an aside against you, man. That's the first thing I get published. Probably, odds are not a lot of people are going to read it. and that's fine. I don't expect to launch with 100,000 sales, but I tell you what, Kurt did Beautiful Creatures, and it's helped build him to the titan of the industry he is now, having sit downs with DC Comics. Guys, listeners, you're going to have to work for free. If you look at most creators, especially the ones with their overnight successes, they started right on the bottom of the food chain. And I mean, most of the current fans don't even go back to check out that work. It's probably never going to find an audience. And those creators probably don't care. I mean, Bendis always tells the story of people come up to him at cons and say, "Oh man, I'm your biggest fan." And he'll say, "Oh, are you enjoying Powers?" And they've got a blank look. It's the way things work. And I mean, we're all going to have to start at the bottom, and it's going to take a while. And you know where I started writing? On my blog. And no one cared. And after a year of still apparently no one caring, I got a gig writing at the Weekly Crisis. So I guess they were looking. And writing for the Weekly Crisis, that was free. And after that year of hard work, I landed a job reviewing comics at CBR. Now, it's not paying my mortgage at the moment, but I love it. I really do. I enjoy doing it. I run the Thought Balloon site, where I write and post one script page a week. That's completely free. I love doing Thought Balloons, though. I love writing that one page of script a week, even when I barely have time to fit it in. I do it because I love it. Are you noticing a pattern? I've got 5 short comic stories seeing print this year, and only one of them am I getting paid for. And it's only in double digits, guys. So, am I doing it for the love or the money there? I'm pretty sure you can work it out. I got a non-fiction book that I've managed to finally land, and that was after years of writing non-fic reviews and gonzo op-ed pieces for free online. You have to put some stuff out there. It's a promise to the publisher that you are worthwhile. Now, I'm only just now getting some publishers interested in my stuff. And these publishers aren't the big two, and it's not Image just yet, and I am fine with that. I want to write. I want to tell stories. And I really hope, listeners, that you do too. But do it for free. Share it around. Have fun with it. It's not a game we play for cash money. It's a game of the heart. And is your heart into it? Well, you're listening to us. So it probably is. Thanks for listening.